evening, Richard S. from Alabama.
Hello, my name is Richard, and I am an alcoholic. And I do live in a small town called Waterloo, Alabama, now, where I reside. I actually did get sober here in San Diego, though. And I remember coming to the very first meeting they had here in the Southern Cal speaker meeting, and this older gentleman spoke here, and he seemed like he had 100 years of sobriety. And I remember I had watched him speak previously, and I had the opportunity to get to know this gentleman pretty well by the time he spoke here. And I remember when I very first got sober, a gentleman drove me to this meeting that he was speaking at, and I didn't know who he was or anything. And it was a big meeting. I don't know where this meeting was or what it was. This guy drove me over there, and I found a gift there, the gift of laughter and sobriety, which something I didn't think I could find because I was going to meetings and being real serious. And the funny thing was, he made me laugh that night so much, it was incredible. And that gentleman, there was a couple of days later, I thought he was like a famous circuit speaker that went around the circuit. And a few days later, I walked in this little meeting at 30th and Grape Street, and he's sitting in there. And I walk up to him, I said, "Wow, you're that famous circuit speaker I seen speak the other night, this and that." And he says, "You have to be an awful sick person to try to be famous in an anonymous program." And at that time, I didn't understand what he was talking about. It took me a while. But, back in Alabama, this gentleman told me this story about a gentleman was going to this bar, and this bar had these big glasses of beer, and he'd get these big glasses of beer. He'd always order three of them. He'd order three of them, sit them around this table, and he'd sit there and drink them. And he'd sit there and drink them. The bartender had seen this guy come in about 2 weeks doing the same thing, and the bartender one day, "Sir, do you know you could just order one at a time, and it'd be cold and fresh. You don't have to sit three of them around the table." He says, "Oh, no, you don't understand. I have two brothers that went overseas to go to work. And we had made a pact that whenever we went to a bar, we'd order three and sit them around so the spirit of each brother would be there." And, okay, I understand. So the next few weeks, the gentleman kept doing the same thing, coming in after work. On the weekends, he wouldn't come in. You know, he didn't come in. So Monday afternoon, he comes in after work. He only orders two beers. He sits them down, drinks the one, drinks the other. He did the same thing the next day, Tuesday. The bartender started to wonder, and he told some of the patrons at the bar, he asked them, "Hey, I think one of his brothers may have passed away. You think I should offer my condolences?" And everybody said, "Yeah, it's a good idea." And he comes in tomorrow, maybe offer your condolences. So he comes in tomorrow, he orders just the two beers again, not three. He sets the two on the table, he starts drinking one. The bartender walks over, "Sir, I want to offer my condolences to you. So I take it one of your brothers passed away is why you're only ordering two." He goes, "Oh, no, sir, you don't understand. You see, over the weekend, my wife took me to church on Sunday. She made me swear off drinking, so these beers aren't for me. These are for my two brothers." And in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, they say, by every form of self-deception, we try to prove ourselves the exception to the rule. And that is exactly something I would do right there. The big book, it tells us how to tell our stories. It says our stories are disclosed in a general way, what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. It also says our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas, and someone spells them out for you, A, B, C. And so that's what I'm going to give you, just a general story of what happened, what it was like, what happened, and what it is like now. The only place I know where to start is at the beginning. Like I said, I actually grew up out here. I was born and raised in a small town 120 miles east here in El Centro, California. My father was a hard-working farmer, and my mother was a hard-working housewife that helped my dad with the farming business. We lived about 7 miles out of town in the country, and you know, we were pretty much a normal family. My father and mother were mixed races, but when I turned 9 years old, I received a lot of presents, birthday presents, Christmas presents, you know, over the years. But the only one I really remember who gave it to me, what it was, and when I got it was this father. My father gave me this brown leather football when I turned 9 years old for my birthday. He gave it to me in the morning before I had to go to school. I remember eating my breakfast fast, going to the backyard, throwing it up and catching it, and he came out and played a little catch with me. My father would wake up early every morning at 4:30 in the morning, and he would go jogging. And a lot of times I'd wake up and go with him. And my birthday was in March, so a few weeks later was spring break. So I decided, during spring break, I'm going to go take a jog with him a couple mornings, you know. But for whatever reason, I'd forget to set my alarm clock. I wouldn't wake up, this, that. And then one morning, I woke up, and I came out to breakfast, and my mother was there, and my aunt was there. My father wasn't there. And I remember walking across the kitchen floor, and they had this hopeless, helpless look of despair in their eyes, and they looked at me. And they, my mom, I sat down, my mom told me, Richard, your father passed away this morning when he was jogging, and he had a heart attack. And at that point, I just couldn't do anything but break down and cry. I didn't know what to do. I broke down and cried, and my father was gone, and we had to go on from there. But in the big book, they talk about something about resentment as the number one offender against alcoholics. It's the one thing that will take you out. And not knowing what a resentment was at that time or never hearing that word, I found out I already was developing a resentment against my father for dying, a resentment against God for killing him. I figured God was in control of everything, and that's what people had taught me. So I resented this God that killed my father. I started getting paranoid feelings against my mother. Maybe she had something to do with it, you know. But the funny thing was, I never seen my father take a drink. I never seen my father drunk. He did have a heart disease, and he had diabetes. Well, a few years later, I remember my mom started buying these big bottles of Madrea Sangria. Now, she wasn't an alcoholic. She'd get these big gallon bottles, put it back in the refrigerator, and it would sit there for a week or two. And then she'd get a wine glass and fill it up, and we'd sit there watching TV, and she'd sip it. It'd take her 2 hours to drink one glass. She'd go back, fill up another one, and she'd sit there, and she'd start to drink another one. She'd take a few sips. Oh, I think I need to go to sleep. She'd go back. She'd get this funnel and pour it back in the bottle, and she'd go to sleep. Well, one night I decided, hey, you know, I think I'm going to try some of that stuff, you know. So I went and grabbed that wine. I was like 11 years old, and I got the bottle. I took a little sip. I said, that don't taste bad, don't taste good. It's, you know. So I took another sip, and I took a drink. I didn't really feel any effects or anything. So I took another drink. But then I decided to chug it. Whoop, whoop, whoop. And then I didn't really feel anything. I took another chug. Whoop, whoop. Then I felt what I heard so many alcoholics describe, that feeling, the effects produced by alcohol. And I felt like I was 1,000 feet tall and all that, and bulletproof. And I felt like I was part of the world finally, you know, all these resentments and everything. And I never felt part of the world that I had, and all this anger I'd built up inside of me. And then all of a sudden that alcohol hit me. And I wanted to scream, but I didn't want to wake my mother up. I was out there by myself. I walked outside in the country there and looked at the stars, and oh, everything was so wonderful. I came back in, I turned on the TV. And at that time, we only got like 2 channels living on the country, one of those antennas that you had up there. And I turned on the TV, and there was the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson was on. And there was a few nights I stayed up late and watched that show, and I never understood his jokes, and I didn't understand what these people were getting all dressed up and sitting around in front of the thing for. And I said, what's this all about? But for some reason, that night, I could understand what his jokes, and they seemed funny. Oh, that was funny. Oh. And then I was watching, and I seen the people all dressed up, and he was talking to them, and I was, oh, yeah, that's good. And finally, I felt a part of the world, and I thought, that's what I need to be a part of, a little bit of alcohol in me. Of course, I didn't drink every day at that time. I was still young, going to school, whatnot. When I was 12 years old, I had a friend that lived down this dirt road from me, and he was in high school already. And, you know, I wanted to become a man real fast after my father died and everything, and I didn't have no one there to teach me to be a man. I didn't know how to go about being a man, but like a regular selfish, self-centered person I am, I thought I should be a man at 9 years old right away, you know, like yesterday, right now. But, of course, it takes, you know, a little bit of time. This guy's a little older than me. He's in high school. He's like a sophomore in high school. So I go down to his house, and he's always when he goes into town to high school, he's always bringing beers back home, and he gets his ice chest, and he hides them in this bush outside. And so I go over there, and we start drinking these beers, and it feels real good. And one day he pulls out this little baggie out of his pocket. It has all this green leafy stuff in there. And I remember in the old cowboy movies how they used to roll up their cigarettes and everything. He does that. He rolls one up out of there, that little baggie and everything. I thought, wow, look, he's like one of them Western cowboys, you know. He starts smoking that tobacco, and I thought, wow, that's pretty neat. And then he hands it to me. He goes, oh, choking on it, hands it to me. I said, well, I don't smoke tobacco. Oh, he said, you'll like this. So I try it, and oh, yeah, you know, that's real good. Then he pulls out this green, a couple of days later, he pulls out this green pipe and put some water in it. We smoke out of it. We smoke out of that. Then he's starting to bring some of his high school friends around. And I'm a little seventh grader, and that seemed like cool that I was hanging out with these high school kids. And these other guys he'd bring out there, they'd drink like maybe 1 or 2 beers and take 1 or 2 hits off that stuff. And And then they'd be, oh, I'm fine, I had enough. They'd all say, give some more to the kid, though. Look at him. If they look at him, his eyes get real red. They'd say, give him some more, and I'd gladly take it. I'd drink some more, I'd smoke some more. And me and my other friend that lived out there, we were the same. We would drink, you know, the same way. And then I'd start laughing, and the thing was, they always got a kick out of this because I wouldn't make any noise. I'd just... And they all got a big kick out of that. And they'd give the kids some more, give them some more, and I loved it. Well, you know, I always had this goal when my father gave me that brown football that I wanted to become like a professional football player or do something with football. So I kind of wanted to, I didn't always want to party. So when I got into high school during football season, I would quit everything and I would just play football. But of course, when the season was over, then the party was on and I'd go right back. And I ended up always seeming to get kicked out of high school, getting thrown in the juvenile detention center. And it was always behind something to do with drugs or alcohol. And I didn't see it at that time. I was just thought as bad luck, you know. Well, the cop should have been over there arresting the burglar over here instead of messing with me, things like that. When I turned, I was after my senior year. In my senior year, I played the football season, but then I thought I was some sort of dealer hustler, and I was selling that little leafy green stuff, and I was making money at it. And I thought, wow, I'm pretty good at this. You know, I can make money. I can smoke it for free. I can drink all day. But the only thing was, I was still on probation, and I was supposed to be attending school. But, of course, if I'm attending school, I'm not in the street making money. So, you know, it's kind of a funny thing. But early one morning, there's a knock at the door, my mom's door. And my mom said, Richard, you're a probation officer here to see you. And I thought, oh, God. So I came out, and he says, come with me. And he says, I didn't have my clothes on, didn't have no shoes on, and I was kind of half-dressed. He goes, go get dressed, and you're going to come with me. And I said, oh, where are we going? He said, to the juveniles at detention center. And I said, oh, I don't want to go there. And he said, well, you haven't been attending school. That's a violation of your probation. And the funny thing was, these students were calling me because they wanted to buy some of that stuff, and I was going to go to school that day. So I told him, sir, I'm going to school today. I promise. And he said, well, that's not good enough. You're going to come with me. So I ended up going back in my room and getting my shoes and everything on, and instead of coming back out, I jumped out the window. I run off, and I thought, you know, there's going to be helicopters and cars looking at me. I went and hid in this cornfield and everything for a little while, and they didn't have no helicopter or anything coming looking for me. I went down to my friend's house that lived down that dirt road and hid out there, and he went back and searched out for me. I went and got my car and all my stash and everything, and I drove up here to San Diego, 17 years old. Now, if you remember downtown San Diego in the late 70s, before Horton Plaza was there, there was a fountain, and right there at Horton Plaza, there was two restrooms that went downstairs. And if you ever went down those stairs, there were people down there that were shooting all kind of stuff and whatever was going on. And there were tattoo places and massage parlors all down Broadway. And Fifth Street had every type of dirty movie place you could imagine. At nighttime, there's all the ladies of the evening on every corner. And I guess you call them the pimps and the gangsters every which way. And I thought, wow, this is my kind of life here. I said, this is where I need to be until I found out these guys really don't play games and they are out for life and they will do you away. And I ended up going to this old run-down, raggedy apartment complex that had a sign for a help wanted sign. And I got a job there as an apartment manager. I told him there was an apartment in El Centro. I knew it just sold to a new owner. I told him, I'm 22 years old, and I've been working maintenance there, and you know how conniving and deceiving an alcoholic can be, and I lied to him, all this and that, and they believed me for some reason, because they gave me a job there. And I was a manager there. I did all kind of maintenance work and everything. It was a run-down, raggedy place. It wasn't a good place to live, really. Everybody there was just like me. We all were drinking and doing everything else together, and I played a lot of full-court basketball at that time, but I really wasn't doing anything to improve myself, but I was drinking and everything every day. But as time went on, I didn't have a high school diploma or anything, but I tried to go to Mesa College. I went to Mesa College because I still had that dream that I wanted to play football. And I thought, well, I should have probably got a scholarship to a major university, like the University of Southern California or University of Alabama or someplace like that. But because of all my getting in trouble, you know, they couldn't give me a scholarship, so I should probably walk on this Mesa College, you know, just wipe these little junior college guys around, you know. But I got out there, and it wasn't nothing like high school. These guys are all big and strong and fast. instead of me wiping them around, they were wiping me around. I was like, whoa, man, these guys are hitting for real out here. This is some hard stuff. I ended up hurting my knee just kind of halfway through the season. And the coach told me something. He said, you know, you just need to sit out the rest of the year, keep coming to practice and working out with us, and come back next year. Now, my mind didn't quite hear it that way. It heard it like, you're not too good, and you're probably not going to ever make it, so you ought to just go and drink yourself into a death of some kind. So I went and I started going and getting Jack Daniel's whiskey every day and drinking more and more. And I was smoking that, that little leafy green stuff, because I started to call it non-habit-forming marijuana. Because that non-habit-forming marijuana, I always thought you couldn't form a habit to it, it's natural. But it seemed like I had to smoke it all day, all the time for some reason. So maybe there was a habit form there, but I don't know. So I was drinking that whiskey every day, and it seemed like I started with one bottle, then I started getting two bottles. Then that Jack Daniels started getting a little more expensive. I found I could buy that big bottle of Early Times. It looked just like Jack Daniels for a little cheaper. So I started drinking that stuff. And at 18 years old, I wasn't able to kill myself for some reason. I kept trying to drink it to die, and it just wouldn't kill me for some reason. And I didn't know what to do, and I wanted to quit at that point, but I didn't think I could quit. I remember a friend of mine went to a rehab center, and I thought, he called an 800 number in a phone book. So I looked in this phone book, and I called an 800 number. I called that 800 number. They said, you need to go to this place here. It's a meeting over here, and young people's meeting, this and that. So I go over there. I sit down, and I listen to these people, and I thought, these people are nuts. They're not like me. I got willpower. I got control. I play football. The heck with these people. And, you know, somewhere in the book, it talks about we take on more physical exercise, read inspirational books. So I decided to start working out hard and doing more physical exercise. I started reading a book about this basketball player named Bill Russell that played with the Celtics many years ago. And I started, that was my inspirational book at the time. And I started reading that and doing all that. And everything was, and I just was staying sober. And I got this little girlfriend, and everything seemed like it was okay. After about 4 or 5 months I stayed sober, that girl said came to me and said she wanted to break up with me. I thought, wow, she wants to break up with me. Here I am doing so good, staying sober, working out. I thought, wow, I think this weekend, just to get over this, I'm going to just have to drink for just 2-3 days over this weekend. Then I'll get back on track. So 2-3 days, 5 days, 8 days, 3 weeks, 4 months, it just kept on going and going. I just couldn't stop. Next thing I knew, I found this stuff called the Peruvian marching powder. You line up like this, and you snort it up, and you could stay up and drink all night, and you could stay up all night and drink more, and I loved it because I could drink more, you know, and I could stay up. When the bars closed, I could go buy some more liquor and stay up all night. I thought, boy, that's some wonderful stuff. Then this guy gave me this great idea. Let's take some baking soda and mix it up and cook it up in something called Freebase. And I said, yeah, I heard a lot of good things about that. I said, people's lives just take right off. Their careers just take right off. I said, that Richard Pryor loved it so much, he lit himself on fire and ran down the street naked. I said, boy, that must be some good stuff. So we started doing that, and I went on a 3-year, I'd have to say it was like 3 years of hell now when I look at it. And at the end of it, I was on this fifth floor apartment building, and me and this guy were smoking, and all of a sudden his face started changing on me into like a monster. And his horns started coming out of his head, and I was seeing all these weird visions looking at him. And a voice came to me that told me to jump. And I went over the window, and I was going to jump. And then another voice came and said, no, don't jump, tell him to leave. So I turned around, and I said, hey, buddy, you got to go. And, you know, he's all strung out on the stuff, too, and he's all, gotta go, what do you mean? I said, get out of here, go, you gotta get out of here. So finally, he gets up and goes, and I was kind of at that jumping off point. I didn't know what to do. I wanted to quit, but I didn't want to quit. I laid there, and I was laying in bed, couldn't go to sleep, didn't know what to do. And then I fell asleep for a short while, and then I woke up, and there was this old rerun of the Bob Newhart show on, that Bob Newhart, where he's that psychologist in Chicago. And he was up on his apartment up there on the balcony, him and I think that Dennis Jerry and some other guy. That other guy had bought a new car, and he kept telling Jerry and Bob, look at my new car down there. It's a real nice new sports car. Oh, it's wonderful. And they kept looking at it. Oh, yeah, that's nice, that's nice. Of course, a bird goes flying by, and the bird did what it does on the car, you know. That guy got all paranoid. Oh, look what that bird did on my brand new. Oh, he got all freaked out. Jerry said, you know, you're all obsessed with that car. It's almost like that car owns you. You don't own the car. You know, that hit me hard. I said, wow, that's like that crack cocaine. I don't own that crack cocaine. It owned me. It took control of me. And I knew I had to quit, but I didn't know what to do. So instead of coming home, I'd go out to the bar all night and drink. So I say, if I stay out all night drinking, I won't do that. Then I knew I wanted to get off the drinking, so I said, that non-habit form of marijuana, you can't form a habit to that. I'll just smoke that to get off the drinking. So I did that. Then I had a plan. I said, I'm going to go to school. I'm going to get a degree. I said, 4 or 5 years, I'll keep myself sober, clean and sober. I'll get a degree. I'll get a good job. I'll get the house. In the back of my mind, I said, once I have that house, I can go in the backyard. Just stay away from all those chemical drugs and just do the natural, you know, the natural alcohol, the natural non-habit form of marijuana, and I'll be all right. So that was my plan. I started going to City College there and taking classes, and I was doing good for a couple semesters. I did pretty good. And then one semester, I had a little break, and this one young guy that lived in that apartment complex I lived at, he says, hey, let's go to the strip club down there, the Dirty Dan, or something on Pacific Highway. And I say, wow, that sounds like a good idea. So I said, let's go, you know. And I said, I just won't drink, you know, I'll just drink a soda or something. And we got down there, and he was drinking a beer, and I thought, you know, beer is just like refreshment. It's not really like alcohol. I said, alcohol is vodka or whiskey or gin or something like that. So I thought, a few beers won't hurt me. So I drank 3 beers that night. That was all I drank, 3 beers that night. And I thought, that's pretty good. See, I'm not really an alcoholic or drug addict. I can control it. So I go home, and then I start going back to school, and all of a sudden these voices start coming to my head. Sometimes I'm in class trying to study. Oh, you're wasting your time here. You need to go out and get a drink. You don't need to be studying in this class. Hey, shut up. I'm trying to listen to the teacher. Oh, no. I said, oh, no, you need to go out and get a drink. You need to get a drink or get a hit of that non-habit form of marijuana. You don't want to be wasting your time in this class. This class ain't helping you. You're not getting paid. Hey, shut up. I'm trying to listen to the teacher, I tell them. But they keep on going and going until eventually I got up out of that class and I went right back to what I was doing. At that point, I didn't like working anymore, and work was wasting my time. I didn't have enough time to drink and smoke that non-habit form of marijuana. And I decided, hey, you know, a good idea, be a professional gambler. I said, I'll have all kinds of time. And the Caliente down there in Tijuana opened the sports betting, and I said, I've followed sports all my life. I'm not a professional football player now, but maybe I can make money off of that way. So I started running down across the border every day and doing that, and at first I did so, not real good, but then of course I hit a hot streak where I was winning all the time. Oh, I know what I'm doing now, you know. But of course that hot streak went the other way and took me back down, and I started losing everything. I lost everything, got bummed down and broke down, and I ended up wanting to get away from it, so I moved to Los Angeles. And I got up in Los Angeles, broken, homeless, and I didn't know what to do, and I was trying to sleep in this park in Huntington Beach, and it was late at night, and the sprinklers came on, and I said, oh, God. I got up, and I started trying to open car doors. Maybe there'll be an open car door I can sit in. Opened the car door, I found one, and I laid in there for a while. And everybody that walked by, I kept thinking, oh, well, I hope he's not the owner. And, you know, everybody, finally early in the morning, I got up, and I got going. In L.A., I got caught up in some bad stuff up there. I got caught up with these gangster people, and we started, you know, selling illegal stuff and doing all kinds of illegal things. But you know, we always were drinking all the time, and we were smoking that non-habit form of marijuana. Life was good. But I knew after a few months I got too involved with them, and I knew something was going to pop off, and I didn't want to be in the middle of all that. And I decided to get up and get away from them, and I moved, of all places, to Buffalo, New York. I took a Greyhound bus all the way across the country to Buffalo, New York. And so I end up there, and I said, I'm going to straighten myself up. I'm going to go to church, and I'm going to be a good citizen of the United States of America. I got a job in this Arby's fast food. I got another job in this grocery store. And I was going to this Mount Airy Baptist Church every Sunday. And when I wasn't working Wednesday night, I'd go to a Bible study on Wednesday night. I'd sit in there and praise the Lord, you know, hey. And I was living in this house with 4 other guys. This guy was renting out a house, and I went in there, and there was 4 other guys living in there with him. There was a rooming house. And one guy in there, you know, like they say, alcoholics and drug addicts attract each other. He was always smoking pot in his room, and he'd always come out, hey, buddy, you want to take a hit? Oh, no, I go to the Mount Airy Baptist Church. I told him, God sakes, I don't smoke that stuff. I work all day. What do you think? Oh, sure, okay, okay. You know, he kind of knew something about me. And then a few days later, he'd be right back. Hey, buddy, you want to come in here? Try a little hit of... Oh, no, no, I told you I go to Mount Airy Baptist Church. And then a few days later, oh, I go to Mount Airy Baptist Church. You know, no, I don't want to smoke that stuff. But eventually it wore me down. And one night I found myself in there hitting that stuff. And the next day I was in a bar and drinking away again. And it all started all over again. And I was doing the same thing. The only thing I did have there was a pretty decent job. But eventually those thoughts came back in my mind. If you go back out to California, you can try it differently this time. You know what you're doing. You can try that professional gambling again. Just one more time. Give it a try. So I ended up getting the Greyhound bus, coming back out here, running. I was staying in the Golden West Hotel downtown. And I thought, wow, I'll try it again. One more time. This time it'll be different. And sure enough, I end up broke and homeless. And I remember I was going to that blood plasma place where they'd, you know, I always thought a real drug addict, everything was a guy that was be putting a needle in his arm. And I thought, well, I never did intravenous drugs. But yet I'd go to this blood plasma place and stick a needle in my arm for 2 hours while they pull the blood plasma out of me so I could go and buy some of that non-habit forming marijuana, go buy a drink. But I wasn't a bad drug addict. That's what I thought. And anyway, eventually that started to beat me down, and I called a friend of mine that was in the program of recovery, and I didn't really know anything about it. And he told me, I'll let you sleep on my living room floor on the couch, but you have to stay sober and go to meetings with me, and I'm going to try to get you into a rehab center or something. So I went and stayed with him a couple of days. He got me in the detox center, and I went through the 10-day program on Island Avenue, and I came out. I said, you know, I'm still really not like these people. My problems are financial. If I just had money to drink and everything the way I wanted to, I'd be okay. I said, that's the real problem. And I heard a word in there, functioning alcoholic. I said, well, I could be a functioning alcoholic. That'd be all right. So I got a job, and I would do what I had to do in order to do all to keep drinking and everything. And I'd lock myself in my apartment and just drink by myself. But every once in a while, I'd want to sneak out and... I end up getting one of those DUIs, and they send me to the AA meeting, and they gave me this court card, you know, attendance slip, and I put it in there and I set it down, and I thought, you know, maybe I should just sign it myself, but I was always afraid those two people sitting in the front, the secretary and leader, were like part of the court system, and were going to tell me, Richard wasn't at the meeting today, and the judge is going to tell on me. So I'd set it down, and then I'd notice people walking outside to smoke cigarettes and whatnot, so I'd go outside and I'd look. And those little sneak-a-toke pipes with the one hit. And I'd take a little hit of that and chew some gum, come in and wash my face and sit there. And I'd listen to some stuff, but then I never thought any of that was sinking in. For the next few years, I kept doing that, and I could feel myself. I was dying inside, and things were getting worse. And eventually, I had a heart attack one day. I went to the hospital, and they did two angioplasties, put three stents in my heart. And I came out, but at that point, my whole life was surrounded by drinking and smoking that non-habit form of marijuana that I smoke all day. And I thought, there's no way I can quit, you know. I had crossed that line like Bill Wilson talks about. We cross that line where it goes from luxury to necessity. At that point, I felt more normal if I had something in my system. I didn't feel normal when I was sober. And so when I came out of there, the first thing I did was do what I do, drink and smoke that pot. And the funny thing was, the effects weren't the same anymore after that heart attack. It didn't make me feel good, but I just couldn't stop. I couldn't quit. And I kept doing it on and on. And then one day I was driving down the road, and you know, I've had many blackouts through my drinking career. And that one day I was driving down the road, and I can just remember I was at one point, and after that I can't remember anything. And I was just driving down the road, and next thing I knew, I thought I was asleep at home in my bed, in my apartment in the bed. Some guy's tugging on my shoulder, are you all right, are you all right? And I thought, did somebody break in my apartment, try to wake me up? I said, geez, who would break in and wake me up, you know? And that was weird to me, but actually when I was in that blackout, some people call it a blackout, I call it an involuntary nap. But actually when I was in that involuntary nap, I didn't know what happened, but that guy was tugging on my shoulder, are you all right, are you all right? And I looked up, and I noticed the blue sky around, so I went in my apartment, And I looked and I seen my windshield was all smashed in my car. And I looked at the mirror and my face was all full of blood. And I had a hat right here next to me that was totally red from all the blood that fell off me, I guess, while I was blacked out, passed out in the car. And I didn't know what happened. And then that guy that was waking me up, he said, I seen everything. He said, you're driving on the East Freeway. And all of a sudden, you crossed the median and you went head on and this other guy was there. And I thought, man, I'm waking up in this. How come I'm not dead, you know? I wish I was dead at that point. I don't want to suffer all the consequences of this. I thought I probably killed the guy. You know, I'm going to have a vehicular manslaughter charge on me. And all this was running through my head at the time. And the guy got out of his car. He didn't have a scratch on him. He wasn't hurt at all. And I was like, wow, you know, I didn't know what to think. Of course, I had all these party favors and stuff in my trunk of the car. And the ambulance comes. The ambulance says, who should we take? Everybody points at me. Take him, take him. So I go to get in the ambulance. I say, hey, Mr. Ambulance, let me get the bag out of the trunk of my car. Oh, don't worry about that. The police will take care of that, he tells me. And I say, no, I don't want the police to take care of that. And he says, yeah, the police will take care of that. And they strapped me down in there, and I couldn't get up. And I was like, oh, God. I go to the hospital for a couple of days. I have cracked ribs and all kind of bruises and lacerations. And you know, I probably should have been dead long before that. But, you know, the guy hit wasn't hurt at all, and that was amazing to me. A couple of days later, this angel in the uniform struts in and puts some silver bracelets around me. Gives me that limo ride in that car I've had before. Takes me to that hotel, the hotel with the bars on it. That's it. I went in that hotel with the bars on it. They gave me this little blue mat and this hard metal bed. And I remember I'd lay on that hard metal bed, and with my cracked ribs, I couldn't get up on my own. And I always hated to ask people for help. I was all self-will, my will. I can do it on my own, self-determination. But I had these two cellmates that I thought were crooks and criminals and every sort of, you know, bad thing I could think of. And the funny thing was, whenever I needed to get up to use the restroom, these two criminal crooks would help me to get up. I'd reach my hand out for help. And in AA, they said, whenever somebody reaches their hand out for help, we want the hand of AA to be there for them. And I remember that came in my mind for some reason, because I'd reach out to these guys for help, and they'd help me to get up. I'd get up, use the restroom. Now, this place had very good hospitality. They just didn't serve you breakfast in bed. They served you lunch and dinner in bed also. They had that little slot right there, and they'd slide it right through. Boom. Lunch and dinner. Those two guys would help me to get up so I could eat my food. And it was the most amazing thing to me. I could ask for help and actually get it. Wow, that was an amazing thing. And like I said, I never liked to ask for help. One day I was laying in that bed, and me and these guys were joking around, and I found myself clean and sober without any drugs or alcohol in my system laughing. And I thought, wow, if I could be happy in a jail cell like this, but I should be the most depressed and sad in my life, I could probably really be happy in the free world if I could just stay clean and sober and not get into trouble anymore. And these little things are coming to my mind. I was talking to one of my cellmates. He was a young kid, about 20, 21 years old. And he was always talking about, I like to smoke ice. Ice is a crystal meth. I like to smoke ice. I like to smoke ice. When I smoke ice, I steal a car because I don't want a car in my own name. He said, I'll get in the car and I'll drive around. If a cop gets behind me, I got 5 to 6 minutes to get away from him. He says, in 5 to 6 minutes I don't get away from him, I can run fast. I jump out of the car and I run. And I say, wow, he can be a fast runner, but he's in here. And then I asked him, I said, you're about 20, almost going to be 21. I said, how many times you been in jail? He says, 8 times. I thought, 18 to 20, 20 to 21, been in jail 8 times. And even though there was something that clicked in my mind about that, because even though maybe he wasn't going to get sober, something clicked, and I hadn't been in jail 8 times from the time I was 18 to 21, and said, this is a disease that tells you you don't have a disease. And I must have heard that in a meeting somewhere, and it must have stuck in there, but I didn't remember it till then. I said, a disease that tells you don't have a disease. I said, that's me. I keep getting in trouble, but man, I don't see it. And just little things like that started to pop in my mind while I was in the jail there. Well, I came out, and I had to see that other angel, that angel in the long black robe. And that angel, he gave me another one of those attendance slips. And that time I didn't call it a attendance slip anymore. I called it a gift card. Because I found out I had this gift card. I could get the gift of sobriety, the gift of life, if I was truly willing to surrender myself. I went to my first meeting. There was a big meeting. It was a podium meeting. And I walked in and I set that gift card down. And they asked, are there any newcomers in here? And I raised my hand. There was about 10, 11 people in there raised their hands. I said, yes, my name is Richard. I'm an alcoholic. And then they went through and they called different names up for the podium to share. And they said, let's get a newcomer up here. And of all the 10, 11 people, they point right at me. Hey, why don't you come up? And I said, who, me? You know? So I said, okay. I walked up and I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to say. All I could say is, you know, my name is Richard and I know I'm an alcoholic and my way of life hasn't been working for me. And all I can do is surrender myself to the program Alcoholics Anonymous. And just by doing that, it gave me a great deal of freedom. It was lifted off me. And I went back to my seat, and after the meeting, all these men came up to me and started shaking my hand and giving me phone numbers. One guy gave me this card and said, if you want to drink, that's your business. If you don't want to drink, that's my business. Give me a call. And I looked at that card, and I called that gentleman a few times and talked to him. Then another guy got me outside and said, you need to come every morning to this meeting, this 7-day-a-week meeting. He was sounding like he was talking real fast. Every day, 7-day-a-week meeting. And I said, well, I'm supposed to take suggestions from people. Okay, so I decided to show up to that meeting. And I started showing up that meeting every morning at 8:30 a.m. Became my home group. It was a meeting called the Early Morning Recovery Meeting at the Serenity Shop. I started going every morning at 8:30 a.m. And slowly but surely, I'd walk in and I'd just listen to people. I found a sponsor there. I started going to another meeting, also a noon meeting. It was called Lunchtime Friends at the Southeast Solano Club. And there were a lot of good people there, and they truly helped me. These both became, I had two home group meetings at that time. A lot of people say you're not supposed to have two home group meetings, but I needed it at the time because I truly knew that I was in need of help. And I'd come in and ask for help, and these men were willing to help me. I found a sponsor at that early morning recovery group. He seemed like he had 100 years of sobriety himself. I think he has coming up on 39 years now. And he told me, are you truly serious about this program? Are you willing to go to any length to get this program? And I said, yes, sir, yes, sir. And he said, if you're really willing to go to any length, he says, you know that portion of chapter 5 they read every day in the meeting, how it works? He says, I want you to memorize that. I said, good God, memorize it. I said, it takes me 20 minutes to read the thing, both pages. And he said, I wouldn't ask you to do something I wouldn't do. And he started, rarely have we seen a person fail this thoroughly far or fast. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. And he went on and on. He went through the whole thing, and I said, good God. And then I was trying to read the book, I remember, and I couldn't hardly read the book, a couple sentences, and I couldn't remember it. This one lady told me, I went in the meeting and shared about it, and this lady says, why don't you buy the book on CD and listen to it? She said, read along and listen to it. I go to this other speaker meeting, and there it is on CD. It said $29. I said, good God, $29. That's a lot of money for a CD. And something came in my mind, and it said, you spend $29 in a few minutes in the disease. You can't spend $29 for your recovery. And there was that small change starting to come about. They say, you have to change one thing about yourself. That's everything. That small change started coming about at that point. My sponsor seen I was serious about the program, and I was memorizing the portion of Chapter 5, and he started taking me slowly through the steps. He got me through Step 1, 2, 3. I remember when I was after Step 3, everything started to come around. I got a job again. I started having a little money in my pocket. I was driving a car around, and everything seemed good. And I started puffing my chest out. Oh, God is good. Yes, sir. I turned my will and life over the care of God. Then those thoughts started popping in my mind. Maybe you could go out and get another drink. I thought, oh, wow, how are these thoughts coming from? Somebody said, you need to go back to Step 1 and remember that you're powerless over the alcohol. And I remember my sponsor asking me, what's that first step say? I said, I'm powerless over alcohol. Oh, you already said it wrong. Oh, he said, say it again. I'm powerless over alcohol. You already said it wrong. And he said, the first word in there is we. We were powerless over alcohol. He says, you can't do this by yourself. You need the group of Alcoholics Anonymous to help you. And these told me, people would say things like God, G-O-D, good orderly direction, or G-O-D, a group of drunks. So I relied on good orderly direction from a group of drunks. And boy, they gave me some good direction. And, you know, time just kept going on, and I started staying sober one day at a time. I was able to recite that, how it works and everything, and things just, it got worse before it got better, but slowly it started getting a little better, a little bit better. After I had about a year in the program, I remember there was a gentleman I used to go to this meeting with, and we both would, you know, put down our gift cards and get them signed. It was a once-a-week meeting, and I'd see him, and we'd sit there and talk. And after about 4 months, I didn't see him anymore. One day I was in a grocery store, and I seen that guy, and I looked at him. He looked familiar, but I couldn't remember where he was from. And he came up to me, and he said, "You look familiar." And I said, "So do you." And I said, "I remember you used to go to that one meeting we'd go to once a week." He said, "Yeah, that's right." He said, "I only had to go about 4 months, and then I got my slip sign, and it was all over with." And he asked me, "Do you still go?" I said, "Oh, yeah, I still go to that meeting." He goes, "How long do you have to go for?" I said, "Well, you know, I'll probably go the rest of my life." He goes, "Boy, which judge did you get?" I said, But I found out I had the best judge of all at that point. I had a loving God of my understanding, and that was the best judge I could have. And slowly but surely, life started to come around. I was studying real estate, and I was doing other things, and I found out, here, I was making my financial amends and doing things like that and all this, working the steps. I made my amends, and I found out I could start getting credit. I said, "Wow, credit. I never had credit before." But all of a sudden, my credit got cleaned up somehow. I said, "Ain't that something?" And I was looking around. I started looking here and locally, and housing prices were very high here. But I started studying real estate, and I started noticing in other areas of the country, housing prices were pretty low compared to here. And I decided to start taking a few trips around the country and checking this out, if this was really true. And I took a trip to Louisiana one time. I took a couple of trips to Alabama, and I went through different areas of Alabama. I took a trip to Oregon before, and I'd always go to AA meetings there. And I found out wherever I went, there was a family of alcoholics there for me. Wherever I traveled, I had a family. And that was something, because my mother had passed away a few years ago. Like I said, my father died when I was young, and I really didn't have much of a family. And I was always so selfish and self-centered to really have a kid or anything, that everything was about me. And so, but wherever I went, there was a family there of alcoholics. And I went to this one particular area in Florence, Alabama, Muscle Shoals, Alabama, and Sheffield. Sheffield became my home group. I went over there, and these people availed themselves to me, and I talked to them. I got their phone numbers, and then I told them, "You know, I think I'm going to move here." And they said, "Well, we'll welcome you in if you do." And I came over there, and I decided to move there this past year, and I moved to this little town called Waterloo, Alabama. I got a good job at this company called the Hahn Company there, make office furniture, tabletops. And my home group is the Sheffield, Alabama group now. And me and another gentleman, he was always doing this, but I started doing it with him as soon as I got there. We go to the juvenile detention center once a week and talk to the juveniles. Somebody said, "You have to give it away to keep it." And even though these kids really don't want it, we let them know, when it gets bad enough for you, when you get a little older and it gets bad enough for you, there's a place for you in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we want to welcome you in when you're willing to come. And that's the message we try to give them. And things slowly but surely were getting better and better. And, you know, I just can't. For me, this program is my whole life now. It's everything. And they used to say about practice these principles in all your affairs. And I used to think, you can't really practice these principles in all your affairs. You know, pick and choose, you know. But I found out, sure enough, by practicing these principles in all of my affairs at work, at home, when I'm out, that life truly is much better. And that's a true gift. I think the bellman was telling me I was running short on time, so I'm going to about wrap this up. I just want to know, does anybody here wear a men's medium t-shirt? Does anybody here wear it? There's two. Well, all right, I got two t-shirts, one for each of you. And I also wanted to show you one other thing. We always talk about the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and most people know this to be the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, this blue book right here, which is the fourth edition. But I wanted to show you, this is a reprint of the first edition. This is what the first edition looked like. Now, everybody tells you to read the first 164 pages. If you look in here, it's a 179 pages in the reprint of the first edition of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so this is what the founders used, and this is what I really just use this book as a prop. I do read through it, but my book, like this one, is marked up, but I don't mark in this one because this is my baby, kind of. And I have a love for it, but I just want to let you know I'm only here due to the grace of a loving God, as I understand to be, the program Alcoholics Anonymous, as is outlined in the big book, and the fellowship, which is you people, because without you, I couldn't be here today. And I thank you all for having me here, and I hope you all have a good night, sober night.